We're joined now by Norman Otis Richmond. Are you there, Otis?
No.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How you doing?
Not bad. You are one of the people who know the most about this, Amiri Baraka. You, of course, knew him personally, but also your work has been in, I'd say, the same departments. Amiri Baraka earned quite a reputation for his books and writing on American culture and black culture, and of course jazz and blues, great book, Blues People. But he was very involved in a struggle against racism and dealing in the issue of the national question for black Americans. And I want to ask you, first of all, I think you told me earlier that you met him in 1967.
Met him at the Spirit House. That's in Newark, New Jersey. And
what was the Spirit House?
The Spirit House was his community center that he called the Spirit House. And I remember going there. And I think I was slipping under into darkness. That time they were looking for me, and I was sent there to see him. And I saw Archie Shepp was backstage, and they were talking about Leta Umbulu. I never will forget that. That was in 1967. I had just left the United States of, I was leaving the United States of America.
Uh-huh. They were talking about what?
Leta Umbulu, the South African musician.
Ah.
She's like Marin Makeba number two.
Wow. Well, what was that experience like? What sort of, how did you find him as an individual walking up to the man?
Well, he was in a room full of people and he was holding court. And that next, the day before, the day after, I actually saw the play, called Jello, which was about Yaqub. Elijah Muhammad has this theory about Yaqub was a white man created, a black man created the white race. Mm-hmm. So at that time, Amiri Baraka had a play called Jello, and the music was done by Sun Ra. This was in Harlem, so I actually saw that. That was in 67.
Oh, my
gosh. I saw his play, yeah. And the couple of days before I left Los Angeles, I saw The Dutchman.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I left Los Angeles, I saw The Dutchman. I saw Charles Mingus, and I remember seeing Frankie Lyman and Zora Taylor, who was one of the Platters. When I was leaving Los Angeles, I remember those three events.
Frankie Lyman?
Frankie Lyman was in Los Angeles at that time.
Yeah.
He was going with Zola Taylor, one of the Platters.
Uh-huh.
And I saw Charles Mingus at UCLA, and he threatened to jump off the stage and beat up some Euro-American. That was, I remember those.
Those were turbulent days.
Right.
Well, that's really remarkable. By the way, Archie Shepp was there at the same time. We're speaking Norman Otis Richmond, and we're talking about Amiri Baraka, but you met the two of them at the same time.
Yes.
How did Archie Shepp regard the man, at that time known as Leroy Jones, right?
They knew one another from the music world. At that time, Archie considered himself a Marxist. I probably still does, but at that time, he was my hero. Archie was my hero because he was writing in a column in Downbeat magazine, and he was calling for supporting Cuba. He was calling for to be anti the Vietnamese War. He was calling for black musicians to be not being ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
So I had bought one of his. His first album was called Fire Music, and I believe it was him and Coltrane got him. John Coltrane got Archie Shepp his contract, but Coltrane and he are sitting together on that Fire Music, and he did that song, Malcolm, Semper Malcolm on that particular album.
Yeah, that was a remarkable journal, Downbeat. That was a very cool publication. Was it in? Do you not remember? I, I recall an article that knocked me out. I think it was in Downbeat. It was the writer was assessing the two great figures at that time in literature, black Americans, James Baldwin and Leroy Jones / now Amiri Baraka. And he said, you know, James is wonderful, and he's our great novelist, but he says, Leroy's going to get us all in trouble. And I don't know if you remember that, but anyway, the Downbeat, that publication is gone now, right?
No, sir, it's still out.
Oh.
It still comes out. Now it is...
Do they revisit their history? They ought to put out a whole issue on Amiri Baraka.
They probably will. Mm-hmm. Randy Weston was in town on Saturday, and I saw him, and he gave me the New York Times, you know, the first part of the New York Times, and Amiri Baraka was on the cover. You know, they had a picture of him, and then they had a whole page on him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I read parts of it, and, of course, they were... it wasn't all glowing, you know. The New York Times is, I guess, what is it, everything...
fit to print.
Fit to print, right.
Yeah. That's an often mocked slogan.
What is it, all the truth fit to print?
Yeah, all the facts, I think, or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right.
It's a nice idea.
Right.
Well, Democracy Now! Devoted an hour to him. I suppose there's going to be more. You know, the last time I saw him, he was on Democracy Now! And discussing, and thank heaven they had him on the show, and they were talking about the biography, the most recent biography of Malcolm
Manny
X.
Marable.
Yeah.
And he was chewing Michael Eric Dyson up, and Michael Eric Dyson was... sounded like J. Edgar Hoover. He was red baiting him, right? Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. That was Michael Eric Dyson came across. He didn't come across too good. It was Herb Boyd, Michael Eric Dyson, and Amiri Baraka. And you know, Dyson was attempting to be respectful to Baraka, but he was basically saying you're out of touch and. You know, that Marxism is dead and you're worshiping white men. And you know, I remember Baraka saying, yeah, Michael, I didn't know that you were racist.
You know, it is, he had, one of the reasons, in my opinion, I want to know what your thoughts, but is that he has left such an impression, and is it, he was a vivid personality with a great turn of phrase. He actually reminds me sometimes, I think of people like Dick Gregory. He had a real power at delivering memorable lines.
Oh, yeah. I remember I told him one time that if he ever had an argument with me, just shoot me. Don't write anything down. You know, you know, just kill me because...
you don't want to be remembered.
I don't want to be remembered by anything he would say because he said that... a guy by the name of Elombe Brass, there was a whole movement against Spike Lee's portrayal of Malcolm X, and fortunately or unfortunately, I was on Baraka's side. Mm-hmm. So he wrote a poem one time, and he called the, Spike Lee referred to all of his films as a Spike Lee joint, and Amiri Baraka said a Spike Lee joint is a Negro reefer that pretends to get you high. I was saying that's cold.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I was once in a conversation with him in a little cafe. I have to say, just to say, I'm really proud I met him. But somebody was telling a story about a mutual friend, and he said, "Well, didn't that guy go over to the cops or something? What did he do?" And the guy said, "Well, yeah, you know, the police had it on him that he was using heroin." He said, "No, no, no." He said, "He wasn't man enough to use heroin."
Well, you know, we brought him up here in 19...
Yes, I want to ask you about that.
We brought him... No, a different book list brought him up in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And I introduced him, I remember. And I also... We brought him up here... When I say we, the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition, we brought him up here on... it was someplace on Danforth and Broadview. I can't remember, but that was during the cultural boycott of South Africa. Mm-hmm. And I saw him many times. I saw him in, I remember saw him the night of the 25th anniversary of Motown. I think it was 83, if I believe it was 80, yeah, I think it was 83, 84. And it was the night that Michael Jackson, they had the Motown Review, and it was on TV, and Marvin Gaye performed Michael Jackson. That wasn't when Michael Jackson was on the top, was at the top of his game. Mm-hmm. And I remember him, he performed with Jane Cortez, who's no longer in the land of the living. Mm-hmm. And he had David Murray, the great saxophonist, playing backing both of them up. And he got off the stage and went right to the telephone. And he must have been on the telephone for 10, 15, 20 minutes. And he jumped off the phone and he came and he ran over and said, I was just speaking to Amina. That's his wife. Mm-hmm. And she said, Michael Jackson tore the roof off the sucker. You know, so he was like, he was really into, he was really into music, period. And he also did a poem. If you go to YouTube, he did a piece called Wailers. And he dedicated it to Larry Neal, who was an African American writer, and Bob Marley. And he—that's if you go to YouTube, you can check that out right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate you mentioning that. By the way, we're assuming you're going to write something about this. Are you at work on something about Amiri Baraka?
Yeah, I spoke to a gentleman by the name of Mitchell Holder, who was a founding member of the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition. He told me, he gave me a directive, executive mandate, that if I ever write anything or say anything about Baraka, to remind people that in Atlanta, it was Atlanta, Georgia, they had the World Arts Festival in Atlanta, Georgia, and John Hendrick Clark had passed during this conference. He wasn't there, but he died during this time, and they took had a meeting, and they appointed Amiri Baraka to like pour libations and to honor him, you know. So mm-hmm. he told me to you know, definitely mention that. Yeah, but we brought him here. I saw him so many times. He was at Guelph University with the William Parker Trio. They were doing the Curtis Mayfield Project, and mm-hmm. I saw him there, and I remember seeing him once in Greenville, North Carolina. That was in the 70s. That's when we were organizing the African Liberation Support Committee, and I never will forget, every time you saw Amiri Baraka, he had a pen and a tablet, you know, and he was always be taking notes. I mean, he was, one of the things about him was he worked, you know, a lot of people couldn't see how he lived for 74 years.
79, I think. 79, yeah, I think it works out 79.
79 or 74, 79, okay, almost 80, right.
Yeah.
But he was born in 34, so yeah.
Yeah. When we saw him here, I was impressed at how much energy he had and how he used it. I mean, he was a smaller fella. He
right.
was obviously a little bit fragile, but he was very intense and clear as he could be. What about in your impression now? You met him in 67 when he was really that dangerous cat from New Jersey, and he had the Spirit House, and it was black nationalism at that time, and he went through a lot of big
off.
Issues.
Yeah, he went
Malcolm X, Nation of Islam, Marxism, and all that. But you know, he was always, seemed to me, he was always on course. He would zigzag, but he was on course. But what about your impression of how he was as you saw him later? Was he the same man?
He was essentially the same. He was just as intense because he supported Amiri Baraka. I did not. And he.
You mean Malcolm? I'm sorry. Who did?
Oh, what I don't say. Amiri Baraka supported Barack Hussein Obama for president.
Oh, yes.
And he was one
Which
of the.
Which surprised many, many people.
Yeah, and he was really. And he was as militant about supporting Barack Obama as he was of. He was into that, so you know a lot of people fell out with him, or you know had disagreements with him on the President Obama question, including myself.
Mm-hmm.
I also had problems with him when he went to a period. he became a Maoist, which was I didn't have a problem with that, but he took the position at one time that the Soviet social imperialism was the greatest enemy of mankind, and we said, oh, you know, U.S. imperialism is that's the problem. But he took that position, and he dropped that pretty quick.
Yeah.
And then there was a period when he became a cultural nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
And at that particular time, I was considered myself a revolutionary nationalist, and I was flirting and studying Marxism and Leninism, and I was in an organization called the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were sort of like the ANC, where many of us were Marxists, some were revolutionary nationalists, but we did not support the cultural nationalists because they were not really talking about an anti-capitalist thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really, many of them were anti-communists.
Mm-hmm.
And he went through that period for a brief moment,
mm-hmm.
A few years, but I was always admired him, and even when I disagreed with him, like I said, I always admired his work ethic, and I read his book. His autobiography is something that I recommend,
mm-hmm.
and that the blues people, you know, that's the classic coming, dealing with the, you know, the music, and go ahead.
Yeah, autobiography, is that titled Far Out and Long Gone or something?
No. I think it's just the autobiography of Amir Baraka.
Just straight up autobiography. Yeah.
Yeah, it's his autobiography, which he wrote, right? And he tells the story up until he became a Marxist.
Yeah.
Another edition coming out.
I wonder, do you suppose he was was completing any works? Can we anticipate some, like, for example, the autobiography, many more chapters?
He was writing. He wrote all the time. He wrote 40 books of poetry, essays, plays. I have a couple of books here with his plays and his poetry, a mixture of He did a play one time called "What Is the Relationship of the Lone Ranger to the Means of Production?" You know, that's a play. I have that in a book, right?
I met him and his fiance once in Washington D.C. and we were going to be on the David Susskind program, and I was talking to the woman with him, and I said, "What's he working on now?" And she says, "Oh, he's got a great new play. It's a comedy. It's about Jack Benny, and Rochester kills Jack Benny." And I waited for years to see that. I guess it didn't. It's probably on a drawing board somewhere.
This
is Otis Richmond, by the way, and we're talking about Amiri Baraka. By the way, Otis, people can tune in to you. Whereabouts?
I'm at uhururadio.com, and I'll be on this Sunday. I'll be doing a tribute to Amiri Baraka. I'll also be talking to a woman from Toronto called The Real Sun. She's an artist, and I'll also be talking to a gentleman by the name of Lynn Bedford. He's writing an autobiography, he's writing a biography of Al Prentice Carter, who was the Deputy Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party, Southern California
mm-hmm.
chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up in the same neighborhood I grew up in. But Lynn is writing a book on Bunchy. And then I'm also on Radio Regent, which is formerly CKLN. And we are on radioregent.org.
Mm-hmm.
That's on Saturday between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. That's every Saturday.
Will there be some music in that? Are you going to be playing anything?
When I do a Baraka's thing, it's going to be mostly music. Like I say, it'll be playing his basically his poetry, because he did a tribute to Curtis Mayfield, People Get Ready, where he's reading his poetry. And there's an orchestra behind him, and there's a woman singing, and he's reading. Then he did this. He did a piece called "Dope," where he talks about he takes on religion,
mm-hmm.
and he also
Opium and the People.
Yeah, and he talks about, I had that Wailers piece where he talks about Bob Marley and Larry Neal, and, you know, I'll come up with
And you're going to play some of that?
Yeah, I'm going to play all of that.
You know, that was a great contribution, I would say, of the Beats, is that they tried to blend jazz and poetry. And that was an interesting experiment. If anybody could pull it off, it would be him, Amiri Baraka.
Well, he was in that crowd in the beginning, right?
He made his first mark there. And by the way, he raised an issue, very important one, that in literature you will find the most segregation and the most white supremacist thinking amongst the people who collect poetry and whatnot. Some of the worst, you know, upper class white snobs run those fields, and that's an important war for him to be in.
I saw him I don't know if I was on the show with him, but it was on TVO, and I might have been with him. I don't know if I was on the air, but I remember him taking on a Euro-Canadian about the canon. She didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
And he went off on her. He was basically saying, "You don't know who I am." It's like you went to this white canon thing. It's like all the stuff I've done. And he was saying, he wasn't saying that he's necessarily shouldn't, he should be in the canon, but he was basically saying that there were no African Americans or Chinese Americans or any third world, so-called third world people that were part of this whole canon was white.
It was like a fortress, and you had to break in. And actually, I remember vividly that he was the guy who was battering the wall down. And the American poets, Kenneth Rexroth, once told a crowd, "Amiri Baraka is the future of American literature." But he said it's going to be a battle. But he said the best poetry is being written by African Americans.
Right.
But of course, the guys running the publications said, "Not over here, it's not." This is Norman Otis Richmond, and we're talking about Amiri Baraka. I guess lastly, you know, maybe we ought to take our hats off to New Jersey. They produced Walt Whitman and Amiri Baraka.
Yeah, Newark, New Jersey, I remember there's a joke. I don't know how appropriate it is, but they were basically saying that the Africans who came from South Carolina, Florida, going up trying to go to New York, when they heard the train driver say Newark, they thought he was saying New York. So that's how a lot of people got to Newark, you know. But yeah, Newark had Salome Bay, came out of Newark, New Jersey. You know, she's still in the land of the living lives in Toronto. Sarah Vaughan, Baraka told me that they used to call her the Avon lady, you know. She was the great jazz singer, Sarah Vaughan, was very big. But Newark, New Jersey produced a lot of the greats.
Yeah, no question. There's something about, there is an important mixture there that would produce great poets, and particularly and people in the vanguard of their time, which is Amiri Baraka from the time he begins. I guess going back, I'll just say he opened with a book titled A Preface to a 20,000 Volume Suicide Note.
There's 40, he had 40 books out, though. 40 books of essays, poetry, plays, and prose on
And the great book, Blues People. I was very affected by that. I assume you were?
Of course. Because I was talking to someone yesterday, and they were talking about how if you read Blues People, he is really talking about the class struggle in the Blues People, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, if you read the Blues People, it's written from, there's a certain set of people that don't like the blues because it's, you know, the Negroes' music, and we're supposed to be listening to Bach and Beethoven, and which is nothing wrong with that, but
roll over Beethoven.
But you're not supposed. That's supposed to be better than John Lee Hooker and the Howlin' Wolf and Dinah Washington, which is not true.
Absolutely. Amiri Baraka, great life, and it's going to resonate for many, many years. Norman Otis Richmond, we're very grateful that you talked to us. We look forward to your article. We'll call you up when we see it.
Yes, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye.
And that's Norman Otis Richmond, a very important figure, resides in Toronto and writes and broadcasts here, and widely known, certainly amongst the best of the blues tradition and the jazz tradition.